479, June 8th, 2010. We've been driving for hours since we'd left the highway and then the main road, going deeper and deeper into uninhabited forest, where the roads no longer formed a grid but were meandering like streams. The mailboxes not visible from one to the next, and most of the homesteads of the previous century had been reclaimed by many species of tree with needle or leaf. As we turned up the driveway, there was not much more than a hint of old pasture and field where the crops had been planted and the milk cows once grazed. Mature trees along the old fence line, some of them so old only silver skeletons remained, blocked much of the view from the road. Instead, there were patches of raspberry and sumac flowing into groves of aspen saplings one way toward the trees, and thistles, daisies, skunkweed, devil's paintbrush, tansy, and so many other weeds of the field in the other. Our tires only made a hint of sound as we crept up the driveway. Grasses and wild flowers had almost totally covered the gravel with barely a suggestion of the two wheel ruts we had to follow. Some sort of European vehicle of the 1950s, complete with faded paint and dust on the dash, strange levers coming out of floor and column, and the musty stench of mildew from the seats. The rusting undercarriage of the car groaned as we came to a halt, and the motor stopped, shaking it and us and releasing a puff of oil smoke. Ursula and I got out of the car. We pulled our bags from the trunk as we took a look around us, taking a deep breath of the breeze drifting through the trees, feeling the travel sweat pulled from our skin and clothing, feeling ourselves become as clean as the air. From where we stood, the house itself was almost invisible, hidden behind waist-high grasses, wild flowers, more raspberry patches and shrubs, the whole suffused in bird call and the drone of bees, creating a kind of silence that unnerved city people. Next to the building there were no trees in the usual sense, but many apple, lilac, honeysuckle, chokecherry, mountain ash, alder, and a few bushes I couldn't name, so that between the shrubs and weeds, only a few corner outcroppings of the various additions to the house, kind of a zigzag of annexes, and the roof itself could be seen, just hints of colorful sand-coated tar paper and glass poking from behind all the plant life. Off at the far end of the structure, which seemed enormous, as though it extended for over 100 feet, and maybe more if it formed an L, a woman was waving a greeting. What drew my attention, though, was a quick movement much closer to us. It seemed another woman had briskly turned and disappeared between some apple trees, into an alcove, presumably into the house itself. She gave the impression of being very pretty and somewhat familiar, although all of this could have been my imagination. As we walked up toward the main entrance and our hostess, I could see a screen door deep within the shadows where the phantom had gone inside. For an instant I hesitated, wanting to follow. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I thought I caught another glimpse of her watching us through a window, and I was embarrassed by my curiosity, as though I'd actually invaded her sanctuary. Our hostess generously guided us into the house. She seemed very 19th century, with a long dress and petticoats, voluminous sleeves, an apron over it all, and her hair pulled back into a bun. She had a handsomeness and self-assurance that made her instantly likable, as though she were the mother in a TV family, Mrs. Walton perhaps. You couldn't help but trust her. Inside, also very 19th century, it was so different from the exterior, which had a shabby shed-like quality to it. A chain of cabins or sheds grafted one onto the other, the work of poor farmers or lumberjacks never having learned how to build a proper house, wrapping balsam logs in tar paper or asbestos shingles, that it came as a mild shock. Within, there was sunlight and woodwork, wallpaper and cupboards, stuffed sofas and chairs, elegant drapes and fine old rugs, china and framed paintings, and coming from the kitchen the fragrances of bread and pies, the embodiment of a long-gone and almost forgotten middle-class comfort. Before entering, Ursula had received a genuinely welcoming hug, then was quickly shown to her room. She was given refreshments and entertainments to keep her occupied. I think she actually took advantage of the situation and went to sleep, almost like she was expected to do so, the bedding turned aside so she could slide right in. The hostess said she wanted to show me something before dinner. We began to walk at a comfortable pace away from the house in the fronting road, heading north and somewhat east, toward the fields and forest behind. Must have been midsummer. The grass was so high and many flowers were in bloom, but none of the fruit trees were ready yet, all the fruit still small, hard, and green. We followed a path, the remains of a utility road, entering a wood that frequently broke into clearings. Along both sides, like in a parking lot, were rows of rusting farm implements, plows, discs, rakes, mowers, harrows, all so old they were meant to be pulled by horses. And scattered along the rim of each hayfield were gigantic boulders and piles of smaller rocks, all covered with lichens and trees twisting and sprouting from the crevices. As with all farms settled on moraine, the hayfields were the dry remnants of swamps surrounded by tree-covered gravel ridges, the rock piles forming a casual boundary. Soon we were at a small cottage, in style and depth of comfort very much like the main house, though looking more like a real building from the outside. Sunlight was streaming in from the west. Our hostess pulled a few shades and led me into a room full of cushions and beautiful old furniture. From a drawer she withdrew a cache of papers, saying these were what she wanted me to see. They were drawings, very accomplished and beautiful, figure studies, both clothed and unclothed, and portraits of a lovely young woman. We began to discuss them, and over time it became apparent that our hostess was the artist, though she was hesitant to admit she had made them. It was difficult not to effuse over the excellence of her work, but even more difficult not to be drawn in by the exquisite face portrayed. It also began to dawn on me that this was the face I'd seen observing us as we'd arrived, no longer elusive, but trapped by the artist and completely observable. Our hostess was also averse to saying much about the identity of the model, though she seemed genuinely pleased by my admiration of her, taking it as some sort of confirmation of what I couldn't say. But the more I said about her drawing, the more she was embarrassed by my praise of her craft, the richness of the modeling and shading, the strength and subtlety of her lines, as though she didn't want to take credit for what was on the paper. The images were lifelike, yet not limited to imitating what was before her eyes, taking on a life of their own and almost drawing me into the artist's, or maybe the model's, imagination, as though there was another world not seen in the drawings, but calling to us all the same. Once we stopped talking, the moment was very satisfying, like sexual satisfaction, like my body turning in on itself. The light of the sun, our hostess, the comfort of the room, and the sublime drawings adding up to something less tangible but more complete than anything I'd known before. I wanted to stay there and float like a mote on the delicate currents of air. I wanted to become part of the room and these two women, and the abundant life around me. But it was time to head back to the main house. We began walking in the direction from which we came. Somehow, even though we were heading into the sunset, I couldn't quite get my bearings. So many distractions, green and waving and calling. The grasses were amazing, the fine, wispy grasses growing in the shade of the trees. There were so many other plants, many familiar, but many new to me. But most of all, it was the grass taking me back to memories of childhood and the varieties of forest foliage that my concentration was broken for a moment. As we were heading up a hill, one I couldn't exactly recall coming down on our way to the cottage, our hostess began to walk faster. She disappeared as she crested the hill. When I caught up to the place I last saw her, somewhat out of breath, nothing looked familiar. The hill was at the foot of an even higher hill, The trail had pretty much vanished from disuse, and there were no signs of where she'd gone or that she'd ever been there. I continued in what I thought was the right direction, though now it was too clear that I'd lost my way and could not get a direct bearing on the sun, the trees fragmenting the light like a prism. It seemed I needed to reach the top of this larger hill, and I began to trudge through the woods, there being no discernible trail. Even now, the grasses and other plants were calling to me, trying to hold my attention. They were so wonderful, I almost gave in, each one whispering in a distinct and miraculous voice. Just as I was beginning to panic, the plants would again speak to me, an invocation too subtle for my human mind to understand, but clear enough to soothe and hold me an instant. Just before the summit, there was a trail crossing left and right. No sign of a dirt footpath, as I remembered the trail we took to the cottage, but still a distinct path. On the other side of it, surrounded by young maple trees, was an ancient semi-buried monolith of smooth stone, looking like the top 10 feet of a giant obelisk, as though it was embedded in hundreds of feet of moraine and only the tip was exposed. There were lines carved into it in extremely low relief, figures and pictographs in a language I couldn't recognize, that weren't even stylistically familiar. The stone itself was very smooth and sooty black, with hints of yellow showing through, as though it had been in a fire, though probably it was the aging of centuries or millennia, like old limestone blackening in the rain. Something kept me from circling the pillar, imagining that the trail would be gone when I came back around it. In fact, a certainty that it would be gone. But the longer I looked at the stone, continued to stroke its surface in reverence and almost worship, even resting my cheek on it to take comfort in its coolness, I came to recognize the figure carved into it, the young woman in the window and in the drawings, as beautiful as ever. It suddenly dawned on me that she was a goddess, an ancient goddess, and that I'd spent the afternoon with her priestess, our hostess. I suppose I should have felt awe or some other form of wonderment. Instead, I knew only fear. To have been abandoned in the forest of a goddess should have filled me with fear for myself. Maybe I was meant to be hunted down or somehow bewildered for her benefit or amusement. But instead I began to worry about Ursula's safety. To all appearances, she was safe, yet it was more frightening than the time she and I were almost washed out to sea, off a Rhode Island beach when she was 13. I suppose it's natural to worry about your child more than about yourself, even when she seems safe, and it's the parent who is obviously in peril, perhaps feeling that by dying I'd be abandoning her. I had no way of knowing what was happening to her, and no way of protecting her, imagining perhaps that our hostess, the priestess, wanted my daughter as a sacrifice rather than an acolyte, or that they'd do something to abstract or obscure her humanity, perhaps turning her into an animal or somehow confine her to this forest. When you know nothing, anything is possible. It became urgent that I find my way back to the house. I began to paw through the grass on the trail, trying to find any hint of direction, anything that would tell me whether I should turn left or right, just one clear footprint to follow. The sun was going down.